You're listening to Conversations with John Anderson, featuring Jennifer Oriel.
Jennifer Oriel, it's great to have you here participating in a conversation. I think people are going to be very interested in what you have to say.
Thank you.
You grew up in Adelaide, but then moved to academia in Melbourne?
Yes, that's right. I studied in Adelaide, undergraduate years, and then I did my honours degree and PhD in Melbourne. And I moved because at the time I was fairly radical, and I was looking for an intellectual community where I could learn more about the ideas. I thought if I were going to be in politics, that I needed to understand the full spectrum of ideas of the side of politics that I was on, and at that stage it was the left side of politics.
That's interesting. I sometimes think that it's hard as we go about our everyday lives to stop and focus on something that I think history tells us, which is that every society, including ours, is the result really of great ideas and often of a great clash of ideas, and that they move over time. So ideas are important to the society that we live in and the shape it takes.
Absolutely. And I think at the time, you know, we've discussed how I was on the left, and at the time those ideas were really born of my father was working class. He grew up in a very poor single parent household, and he really struggled to get a decent education in Scotland at the time, in Glasgow. And so even though he was conservative culturally, he always remembered that poverty and the difficulty of that poverty, and how much it was an impediment for many people to realise their full potential. And so for me, being on the left side of politics meant working with people who were very disadvantaged, and being able to create a better society where they would be given the opportunity, equal opportunity to achieve, and not have to have the impediments that my forebears had in Scotland.
I spoke recently with Melanie Phillips in the United Kingdom, and she tells a very interesting story of growing up in a very tough working class environment, and saying that for her, the Labour Party and the left were her natural home because they looked after the interests of the poor and, as she puts it, defended family vigorously. But over time she found, she would say, she didn't move, but the left did. Was that your experience?
Yes. I mean, my earliest interests were the pursuit of truth and the equal treatment of people. And so for me, that is really what I thought the left represented. And for a time, I think it did. I mean, there were flaws in the approach, and serious flaws. But there was this basis of helping the poor and creating strong community. Because that was the basis of grassroots activism that would change the system wherever that system was unfair or created structural disadvantage for people. And by the time I was in my late 20s, I started to see, after having spent a long time on the left, I started to see that the left was really moving away from truth. I thought that it wasn't allowing the truth, even about biological facts, to be told. That it had really rejected the Marxist concept of a scientific society. It wasn't really supportive of the scientific method in the humanities, where I was working. And this desire to help the poor and work at the grassroots and really work with community had been replaced by a kind of elitism and a very cheap identity or minority politics, whose central aim was really to suppress dissenting thought. And that rejection of truth, the rejection of public reason, the rejection of the scientific method, revolted me to the degree that I started to move to the right of the line. And no one was more surprised than me with that change in direction.
So on this question of who moved, Churchill used to quip that because he moved around amongst parties, that it wasn't he wasn't moving, the parties were. I found it very interesting in my early days as a young member of the federal parliament to talk to some of the old figures from the left, where I found that I might have disagreed with their policy prescriptions, but I found their underlying motivation quite noble. They're about what I think Peter Baldwin would call universalism.
Mm.
We wanted the poor, the weak, the oppressed, those who weren't given a fair say, he would say, full recognition as Australians, full status as Australians. And he deplores the idea that the party's moved away, his old party's moved away from that to identity politics. So who's moving in this debate?
Well, a friend, I've been in Adelaide recently, and an old friend said, I have to ask you a question. And I said, oh, what's that? And she said, well, you used to be left-wing in your 20s. What happened? And I said, well, my principles are the same. They haven't changed at all. But the left has changed. So I had to go, and I was heartbroken. I left friends behind, I left long-term relationships, and I was very passionate about what I perceived as left-wing beliefs at that point. And so it was very difficult to go to the right side of the line. But for me, the pursuit of truth, support of public reason, freedom of thought and speech, support for the scientific method, particularly in public policy, so that we could attach the intent of public policy to clear outcomes and measure that so that we weren't wasting taxpayers' money. These were things that were very important to me, and I couldn't get support from them on the left anymore. And another thing that really, I suppose, tipped me over the edge was the hatred of Western civilization. Why would you hate the free world? Why would you hate the freest culture and civilization in the world? I mean, we can critique Western civilization, of course, but that shouldn't be the... When you're living in a world where the majority of states are unfree, the majority of people are living in states that are unfree, in communist and Islamist states, why would your focus not be on reforming those states? Why would it be constant criticism of the free world? So I found that, you know, it was a reckoning. I had to recognise, and it was very hard to do it, that the natural home for public, for reason and truth and scientific method and community was no longer the left. It was to the right side of the political line.
To go back to those questions that you've just posed, what do you think the answer is? Why is it now such a focus of the left to decry our own cultural heritage and our own freedoms? What do you think the answer to that big question is? Why? Why are we now into this terrible self-loathing?
We've been convinced, as a result of a number of major events in the 20th century, that the West ought to carry the burden of collective guilt. And it's not only an ought to, they've turned the public admission of collective guilt into a virtue. It's kind of a ticket for the admission into the politically correct left. You have to decry the founding and foundational values of the West to be a part of the modern left. And the modern left, it's not, I don't know what it is. It's neo-Marxist in political terms, which means it's informed by what was called the New Left in the 1960s. And that was a departure from working class politics and a transformation from the politics of class disadvantage, Marxist politics, to minority politics, as it was known. And it meant that simply by being female or by being black or by being gay, that you were automatically considered more virtuous and entitled to special protections and special privileges under the state. And those regimes were translated into affirmative action law. That is the embodiment of inequality. It's formal inequality. It ensures that people are treated unequally under the law. It's an absolute rejection of universalism for particularism, a tribal ethic, where the left once supported the idea of a whole community working cohesively together and unified around the belief in equal opportunity.
So given now that very large numbers of young Australians go to universities, and let's be frank, the universities have been almost totally captured by people who no longer believe in the traditional Western model of reason and of the pursuit of truth and of civilised debate, the frightening thing to me is that it mightn't have mattered once when so limited numbers of people went to university. Now vast numbers of young people do, and it's very hard for them to hear an alternate view and to really find their feet in terms of what they might think and believe themselves, because it's very hard to get an opposing set of views. Mm. How do we resolve that? How do we put before people, you're very active, you write widely, hopefully some people will listen to this conversation and start to think these issues through a bit more, but how do we challenge what has become the new conservatism?
It's an orthodoxy, and you can really only challenge it by, I mean, if I were a leftist looking at this question.
Which is what I meant by new conservatism, by the way.
So now we're
to be orthodox today, or to be conservative, is to essentially hate the foundational pillars of our own society and its emphasis on reason and the pursuit of truth.
Mm. Well, in the 1990s, when I was a young leftist and you know, thought revolution was coming every morning, we used to talk about structural disadvantage. And part of that is a lack of proportional representation in major institutions such as universities. So we really need, we've tried for, I mean, the march through the universities occurred in the late 1960s, but really came to fruition in the 1970s. And the campus was chosen as a site for revolution because young people are naturally optimistic about the world and they want to make it better and they have the energy and vigour to sustain activism, and they're often not working as much and don't have kids and a mortgage, so they have more time. So those young people were critical to bringing about the neo-Marxist revolution, which had at its centre a belief that there had to be a new radical minority because the working class wasn't revolutionary enough anymore, and there had to be a new radical minority and they would be used to bring about the demise of the West. There were various permutations of this across the world. Orientalism was one part of it, so the belief that third world revolutions would, against the West, would be critical to bringing down the Western model of government. And the forefather of the neo-Marxist or the New Left architecture was Herbert Marcuse. And he wrote a brief essay, you can find it online, called Repressive Tolerance. And it described the method by which this new left would come about. And it was to promote the new radical minority, as it was called, to positions of power in areas such as the media and education, but the public square generally, and to force out conservative points of view. So the idea that the left should become a sledgehammer of censorship was born in that era. And collective guilt was part of the way to bring down pro-Western people and to bring down conservatives, because it was based on disesteeming Western society. It didn't only come from Marcuse, the idea that Western society should be disesteemed and the leading values should be disesteemed was promoted by social psychologists as well, such as Lewin, Kurt Lewin. So, and in part, I mean, let's look at the time at which it occurred. Civil rights were in their infancy. Minorities were treated appallingly. The Jews had just come out of the Holocaust, where the father figure, you know, the Führer, was paramount in the destruction of an entire people. So, and women had no power really either. If I had been there in the 1960s, I would have marched with them, because I believe in basic human equality and universalism. But in the late 1970s, and that's very good that we had civil rights, it's a very good thing, that the idea of formal equality was enshrined in law, and I think it's brilliant that change came about. In the late 1970s, when the welfare money was drying up, and the news about communism, communist states, the brutality of those states started to come out as dissidents escaped to the West, it was no longer possible to support this really revolutionary ethic without mentioning anything about these totalitarian regimes and the failure of the Marxist-Leninist model of state. And in the US, critical theory emerged. Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a very well-known critical theorist, writes about how groups of in law schools in America, critical theorists started to say, well, we need to change tack. You know, we're not getting what we want in terms of legal transformation. It's not enough. So they started to adopt legal critical theory or critical legal theory or critical legal studies. And the aim was to change the law and to promote, again, this minority agenda by introducing affirmative action laws. And that would stop black letter law. Now, the effect of that has been disastrous for the left, and it's been disastrous for the Western belief in universalism, the Western belief in formal equality, the beliefs that underpinned the civil rights movement, which was essentially a movement for recognition of equal human worth. That all changed in the, as a result of this new left. And it's unrecognisable now. It now has become what conservatism once was, which is the promotion of a privileged minority to positions of power, not by virtue of merit, but by virtue of cultural supremacy. And it's appalling. That's why we're in the state we're in. And that system, that legal system, has to be dismantled. And I think we would need to introduce counteractive laws to try to counteract, for example, the lack of political and intellectual diversity on campus. I mean, let's have political and intellectual diversity as a recognised attribute in affirmative action law. Let's get equality back into the academy.
It is quite extraordinary that somebody commented the other day that ambivalence is the postmodernist, ambivalence in language is the postmodernist's best friend. That word diversity, it seems, means everything except a range of views and opinions, which are so critical to a functioning democracy.
It's skin, it's the politics of skin, I call it, skin politics. You know, what's your melanin count? How black are you? How female are you? How much do you fit into a state-anointed category of affirmative action privilege? If we don't start, I don't think at this stage it's worth trying to work within universities, and I know that sounds defeatist or fatalist, but people have been trying it. If you know the history of the past 50 years, the best and brightest minds, the most resolute free thinkers have tried to work within the academy to change it. They haven't been able to do it, and I don't like our chances.
I'd be the last person to suggest that the West's got everything right. But part of its genius, I think, has been is that it's worked away at improving itself all the time. And when something's plainly been wrong or needed addressing, in the past we've found reasonably civil ways to do it. Now we don't seem to be able to agree on how to find a reasoned way forward. We seem to resort to loathing, hatred, and name-calling of the worst order. What's changed?
It's a good question. It's a difficult one to pinpoint in history, when it changed and exactly what it was. In part, I think the antipathy towards the West has meant that its finer points, its contribution to the world at large and to the development of freedom in the world has been lost. The West is now viewed as an oppressive leviathan whose people did nothing but conquer other nations, use up their natural resources, put them in chains, and live off the spoils. But there is a long, long history. You have to know history to understand what the West has given to the world. And part of course, the Marxist tradition, and certainly the neo-Marxist tradition, is the suppression and rewriting of history. And when that happens, people have no anchor. There is no ground on which to move. To really understand the future, you have to understand the past. And when you lose that sense of length of time, when everything contracts, it becomes survival of the fittest. But we're also dealing with one of the fallouts from neo-Marxism, from this idea of the privilege of the minorities, of selected state recognised minorities, is that the movement towards the universal public good becomes tribalist. It descends into tribalism. And I think what we're seeing now is a society that is acting like a tribal society, a pre-civilization society, where everyone is in their separate tribes, and reason isn't mediating that. That was the great mediator, and Christianity isn't mediating it. That was another great mediator. And so instead we have a very vicious kind of public discourse.
This inability to communicate, indeed the deep level of antipathy and hatred that you see played out by the tribes against one another as they live within their own bubbles via social media, seems to make it, as you say, difficult to imagine how we're going to rebuild the ability to respect one another enough to communicate. And I wonder whether you can resolve any great policy issues in a country like Australia if we can't again find common cause and a decent argument rather than slanging matches.
Well, you have to remove the reward for tribalism and you have to introduce penalties for it. And at the moment, all the rewards, the financial rewards, the professional rewards, the social rewards, lie in being tribalist. People get followers on social media by attacking viciously the opposite camp. And that can come from the right and it can come from the left. The aim is to destroy. It isn't to cultivate learning. It's to destroy your opponent. And the rewards are that you are seen as loyal to the tribe to the degree that you attack the collective enemy. The whole identity of the tribe is based on less on shared values and more on the common enemy. And so you end up with a very aggressive culture where people who, for example, might say, oh, well, I think so-and-so had a fairly decent point. Someone who might try to be reasonable in the midst of that kind of slanging match is seen as disloyal to the tribe. So it creates a black and white scenario, an us and them world, where you can't really introduce public reason without suffering social penalty for it. One of the ways to, I suppose, to try to reintroduce public reason is to have debate and logic taught as a mandatory part of the curriculum for undergraduates, so that they learn how to think, not what to think.
Perhaps a little less confusion between thinking and feeling would be helpful.
Absolutely.
Reason and emotion.
Yeah, so the idea of public reason in ancient Greece was perfected, and you learned how to take a point, usually that you disagreed with vehemently, and you succeeded to the degree that you could defend that point. Now, that does two things. It teaches you how to think, not what to think, and it also teaches you to be more sympathetic to the opponent's point of view. If students don't know how to think, if they aren't taught the specific Western method of thought, and it is a specifically Western method of thought,
which,
logic,
by the way,
reason,
served us very well in the past,
I would argue. It has. And it's very, very different to, for example, the greatest, I think, if you look at the history of the 20th century and the most successful, if we can say that, totalitarian leaders, they each contributed something particularly horrible to human destiny. And Mao Zedong perfected the use of thought as a weapon of totalitarian control. And he introduced the idea of that the ideology was the end point of thought, not truth. So ideology, correct ideology, politically correct ideology, was the conclusion of thought. And that's very different to the Western method, which had truth as the conclusion of thought, the revelation, the unveiling of truth, whether that was natural truth or divine inspiration, that was the end point. And if that is your end point, it's markedly different. Your society is different, your education is different to a type of society where the politically correct version of the truth is your concluding point. You must arrive there.
Well, let's try and ground this a bit then by saying I was sitting on an upended tin talking to another fella out in the bush the other day, and he doesn't have a formal education, but he's smart. And he was asking some hard questions. He said, you know, everything seems to be going to custard. All the old certainties are gone. It's all confusing. We all seem to fight each other. What's happening and where is it leading us? So in other words, for people who are not engaged in these sort of heady debates but sense that things are going wrong, the question I think that needs to be put before, for example, all those academics who are against a Centre for the Study of Western Civilization, where are they trying to take us? What is their view of a better society?
You don't know when you're in the left. You don't think about... This is what I'm saying about it's a non-thought movement now. You don't think about where society is going. You think about, am I doing the correct thing? So in every conversation, say I'm a feminist, and I am one to the degree that I believe in formal equality and the recognition of basic human equal worth.
Pretty hard to argue against.
Yeah, but that feminism is now something entirely different.
It's moved on.
It really has moved down. And so what I think is that when you're on the left, I was on the left, I had no idea about Herbert Marcuse. Never heard of him. I had no idea that I was living that ideology. So you don't know that you're in it. And you don't aim at, you don't think about where will this be in 50 years. You're just immersed in the battle and your conclusion is more power to women.
So Jennifer, coming to the great debates about freedom, the debate over religious freedom, we saw the Prime Minister at the time, Malcolm Turnbull, say that even though he was a vigorous supporter of same-sex marriage, religious freedom was even more important to him than same-sex marriage. And Bill Shorten came in behind him, the alternative Prime Minister, and declared that religious freedom was of vital importance in his worldview as well. But the first question arises, because one wonders what they meant by religious freedom, what is religious freedom?
Religious freedom, properly conceived, is the freedom to exercise religion in society. And that was the definition articulated by the Vatican in 1965. And the reason it matters, that their declaration on religious freedom matters, is because it presents religious freedom as a positive right, a positive liberty. So it's the freedom, there's 2 points here, the freedom to exercise religion in society. So we're saying that freedom, it isn't freedom of thought, it isn't just freedom of conscience, it isn't just internal. It's a foundational part of our culture, it's a foundational part of Western civilization, and it's fundamental to our way of life. When the concept of religious freedom was introduced by the, or adopted by the UN General Assembly a year later in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, it presented religious freedom as a composite right. So it was freedom of thought, conscience and religion. And that's really problematic because it provides an unclear definition of all of those terms.
Right.
It's trying to please everyone. And so I think the other definition is much better. When I'm saying that it's superior to the current definition in the UN and indeed in our constitution, in section 116 of the Australian constitution, which really presents freedom of religion as a negative liberty, the right to practice religion or the right to have a religion free from undue interference by the state. But when you have the concept of freedom to exercise religion in society, you're transforming it into a positive liberty. That is, I have the freedom to act and I have the freedom to act free from undue interference and intervention from the state. And it's critical that that definition is understood, because there is no freedom of religion unless there is the freedom to exercise it.
Jennifer, many people would argue that religion's dying out. Ignores what's happening globally, but certainly in the West, the evidence would suggest that they've got a point, and that that's a good thing, that religion is a cause of strife, of war, of discord, of misery, and that it's a good thing to continue to marginalise it, force it out of the public square. So that far from protecting people's rights in this area, we're better off, if you like, continuing to push it out?
There are, of course, wars and strife that are justified on the basis of religion. There have been religious wars throughout human history. We now deal in an age where we've just come out of the most vicious genocidal war created by Islamic State. And they used appeals to the Quran to justify that war. But if you're looking at the last 100 years, the most murderous genocidal ideology wasn't religious, it was communist. Communists killed, on scholarly estimates, around 100 million people in 100 years.
Four times the population of Australia today.
No one is really arguing that because of the genocidal legacy of communism that Marxist-Leninism should be written out of history and forced completely off the public square, out of the public square. And yet we have this argument for Christianity. When we speak of religious freedom in the West, we're speaking about a particular rendering of the idea. It isn't the freedom to go about and haul someone before a Sharia court or stone someone to death because they're not respecting the particular rules of a doctrine. We're talking about Western freedom of religion that has been heavily influenced by the Judeo-Christian tradition. In the second century AD, Christians were accused of atheism because they wouldn't worship the gods of the state. And they wouldn't worship the gods of the state in part because they had a scriptural justification for not doing so. Christ said, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's." Christianity provides the ultimate defence against totalitarianism. It has a scriptural defence of the limited state. Moreover, Christianity provides a scriptural basis for what we now know as the liberal democratic state, based on the ideas of universalism, the inherent worth and dignity of the person, and the secular model of government that we've come to appreciate. All of those are based in Christian scripture. It's lost on most of society now because in Australia, as in many other parts of the West, we are becoming less and less religious. Christianity is losing its popular appeal, in part because people are no longer reading the Word of God. I would encourage people to read it even if they're atheists. Encourage, Dawkin has said, read the King James Bible just for the beautiful language in it. Appreciate it as a cultural artefact even if you don't have
Richard Dawkins has said that.
Yes, because of the superb language, because it provides a great lesson in the English language. And we're now getting to a point where there's such a cultural cringe about Christianity that people can't even appreciate it from an aesthetic perspective. They don't want to look at how the belief in the divine has inspired the greatest art and music and literature of Western civilization. So when we start to talk about doing away with Christianity and addressing the question of, would we be better off without it? Well, no, because it's the basis for liberal democracy, it's the basis of the secular state, it's the basis for universal morality that guides our law and our political systems, and it's the basis for that absolutely critical Western conception of individual human worth, that is, imago Dei.
This idea that we're losing out because we don't, not only not, don't practice, but don't understand the Christian faith and its influence on our society, is something that I was reminded of the other day when I came across a very interesting quote from Menzies, our longest serving Prime Minister. He said, "Democracy is not so much a machine as a spirit in which we acknowledge different capabilities, people's different roles, and we don't try and pretend they're all the same," I'm paraphrasing, "but we do recognise what he called the spark of the divine in each, and that each soul has value in the eyes of heaven," which is a very interesting concept. If you lose sight of that, it seems to me, you struggle to find a basis to maintain the Western ideal or a framework for saying that each individual does have worth and dignity. On what basis do people have worth and dignity if you don't believe in a higher being saying everyone has worth and dignity? And that seems to play right into the idea of tribalism, where we don't respect the worth and dignity of our fellow Australians if we disagree with them?
Well, the great civil rights leaders spoke about this. You must judge a person, Martin Luther King, you know, judge a person by the character, their character. You look into the soul of a person for their human worth. You don't look at their skin colour, you don't look at their sex, you look at their substance. And this concept of each of us being born in the image of God, in his image, it makes it impossible for biblically based Christians, and by that I mean not just people who rock up to church once a week and gain absolution, but people who really understand the basis of living in a Christian manner, that you have to see a person, even in their worst moments, as someone who is capable of much more, someone who was put on this earth for a much greater purpose. So human frailty becomes more acceptable. We learn to care for the sick because they're godly. We learn to care for the frail. We learn to care for the poor, not because it's ideologically correct, but because deep inside us we were taught from a very young age that each of us has a God-given mission, a God-given purpose to fulfill. And if we kill a person, if we rob them, deprive them of liberty, we're depriving them of God's mission for their life. And so it's impossible to treat people very, very badly in a long-term way. I mean, all of us have moments. I do. But it doesn't stop Christians being bad, that's for sure. But it just means that there's always a better place to return to. You have a guideline, you have a path and a goalpost that reminds you that is not the way to behave. It's not the right way to behave. It gives you a sense of very basic morality about how to treat a fellow human being. So I think in terms of the sense of community, the sense of the universal good, the sense of what's right and wrong, and the ultimate sense of forgiveness of sin and redemption, all of those are bound up in our belief that we are born in the image of God and here for a specific purpose designed by him. But it also leads to formal equality. The civil rights movement was very Christian-based. You know, civil rights leaders were inspired by Christianity, and they believed in the inherent worth of the person, consistent with Christian scripture, and were able to, I think, take that spirit through the movement. It's very hard to define. I mean, I see a similar problem with Indigenous recognition. There's no real language in a highly industrialised society, in a materialist age, to describe the worth of the soul, because we don't really have the language for the soul, I don't think. I don't think it's the right language in the West and in public debate. We're told that you can only legislate on tangibles and on material goods and so forth. And that to a degree is true, but we have to find a way for the liberty of the soul to exist. And that's part of the reason that freedom of religion has to be framed as a positive liberty, not just a negative one.
I had a vigorous debate only recently with a very highly educated young man in his early 30s, medical graduate. And he argued vehemently that all the great belief systems and all the great religions insist on the worth and the value of every individual. He wasn't able to provide any evidence. In fact, he literally said, let's Google it.
Mm.
But it is a common view.
Mm.
That if there's anything to be taken out of religion, it's that we should all love each other.
Well, yes. And Jesus was the greatest advocate of that. But no, it's not common to all religions at all.
Mm. There's a stark contrast, it seems to me, between the idea which would have been generally recognised as pretty healthy for society, that you ought to love your neighbour and do unto them as you'd have done unto yourself, and the modern version, which seems to be all rules-based, it's all regulation-based. We'll bind you up, we'll tell you what you can say, therefore what you can think. We will prescribe how you will treat other people and what you will be allowed to say to them, what you can't. I'm not sure that's genuine freedom, but it seems to be the modern prescription from the politically correct.
Hmm. Well, as I said, the Christianity provides the ultimate defence from the totalitarian state. It gives us a limited state, and it gives us a guide for good living within the limited state. To have a limited state, you have to have public good.
Yeah.
You have to have a strong community.
Yeah.
You have to have structures that can withstand all sorts of pressures, internal and external shocks, such as wars or invasions and so forth. And if you don't have that community, if that falls apart, the state becomes indispensable. It takes the place of something better.
You mentioned Martin Luther King, and the left seem to be very fond of saying that they are carrying on his tradition. We need to stop and think about who Martin Luther really was. He was a remarkable man.
He was a remarkable man and a remarkable Christian. Mm. You know, when you listen to his speeches, it's a preacher. He's completely inspired. Mm. You can't listen to him speak and not see what we call the Holy Spirit in him. I mean, it's extraordinary. He sort of inspired not only a return to the gospel understanding of the inherent worth of the individual, of each person, and the legal recognition that we must remove impediments to the development of and the realisation of human potential. He also sparked what should have been a cultural revolution that was not dissimilar to the cultural revolution that Christ sparked in his day, which was we don't believe in hierarchy and privilege set by bloodline. We don't believe in it as Christians. We don't believe in hierarchy set by race. We believe in the inherent worth of the individual and that God is in each of us and that we have extraordinary potential that can only come to fruition if the state is limited and the person is allowed to be free to reach their highest human potential. And we would say God-given potential. But I think it's important to say you don't need to be Christian to believe in these things, obviously. Many people who aren't Christian and aren't religious believe in them. But you do need to be truthful about the origins of these beliefs, of the belief in formal equality, of the belief in the individual that make Western society Western, and they're rooted in Christian scripture.
It's a very interesting point that you make, because in an age when more and more people declare themselves to be atheist, there's quite a notable divide there, and I don't want to sound disrespectful, but there are atheists who will just simply slag off at Christians and anything Christian. There are many who will say, I'm an atheist, but I recognise plainly the role of Christianity in creating the society that we've had. And I even know a couple of atheists who have said, only a return to Christianity, even though I don't believe in it, will re-secure our future. I've actually heard atheists say that.
Hmm. Well, my father was one of those. He was the greatest lover of the Western canon I've ever come across. And he simply couldn't believe in God. But he said, Christianity is indispensable to Western civilization. There is no Western civilization without it. The aesthetics, the beauty, the transcendence, the architecture, the art, the writing, all of the greatest contributions, all of the most transcendent and beautiful moments in Western civilization were creation from veneration to God.
It seems that one of the ways in which we might define the cultural battle at the moment goes to the heart of whether the state is a function of the people or the people are a function of the state. And the separation of church and state is something people now prattle on about without, I suspect, often understanding. It's actually a Christian concept. Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, but no more than that which is Caesar's. How did we get into this mess?
Well, secularism isn't purging religion from the public sphere. It's never meant that. It means a separation between church authority or God's authority and state authority. So each is recognised as a sphere of authority and not as not necessarily at war with each other. It can be consistent to have those. And in fact, in England, one of the earliest defences of religious liberty was created by someone who, Thomas Helwys, who talked about the need for King James to recognise the limits of his authority and not pretend to be an intermediary of gods on earth, not pretend to be appointed by him for the purpose of creating a theocratic empire. There's a distinction here again between the limited state model that we have in the West and the totalitarian model. In Enlightenment thought, this really was teased out because Enlightenment theorists often wanted a much greater role for the state in human affairs and also in spiritual affairs, as we know. The theorist Jean-Jacques Rousseau thought Christianity was a Christianity, not any religion, but Christianity posed a particular threat to the state, the model of state that he wanted. And I'll just read what he said. He rejected Christianity as a religion of the true state because of its secularism.
Really?
Yes.
Would you say that again?
He rejected the idea of Christianity as the true state because of its secularism, because of the secular basis of Christianity. He wrote, "Christianity as a religion is entirely spiritual, occupied solely with heavenly things. The country of the Christians is not of this world." And he also said, "Christian charity does not readily allow a man to think hardly of his neighbours. The spirit of subservience which Christianity embodies would prevent any real flowering of the martial spirit." For totalitarians, it's essential that the state is big, it's interventionist, it's very controlling, and it's kind of based on a Spartan model of survival of the fittest, the martial spirit that Rousseau described. So, like Rousseau, Nietzsche, Hitler, they're very vicious totalitarians and nihilists, believed in the Spartan model of democracy, not in the Christian model of democracy, which is the limited state. And of course, we've had this conflict throughout the centuries of Christianity, where the church has adopted a theocratic model. But there have always been freethinkers, Christian freethinkers, who have tried to reject that model and tried to break it down, as we see in the Reformation, and as we see especially in the development of American Christianity, a Protestant model of Christianity. So it's very important to understand that the totalitarian model is directly antagonistic in history to the Christian model of state, if you're talking about the Christian model of state derived from Christian scripture, not from the perversion of that scripture for the gain of seeking temporal power.
So to turn that around and look at it from another side, do I hear you saying that protecting religious freedom and people's right to speak to it, assuming that there are people out there who are then prepared to use that freedom and those rights, is about the best guarantee we can find against the creeping influence of the state drifting towards more and more control over our lives, costing us more and more of our freedoms?
I'm saying that the government has a tricky, tricky job ahead of it to ensure that the Western model of religious freedom is the model that is legislated in Australia. There are many countries in the world where theocracy exists. And one of the great conflicts that we are going to come up against is the difference between the Western, the Christian model of religious freedom and the Islamist model of religious freedom, which is actually theocracy under Sharia law. So there are going to be, it's going to be very tricky to navigate. The more that our political leaders understand the Christian concept of religious freedom, the more the legislated idea, the legislated right, will reinforce liberal democracy in Australia.
Well, I can see instantly that this is not going to be easy. For one thing, the idea that somehow the West might have something right and that our cultural underpinnings might be peculiar and worth defending flies in the face of all of those who now insist on cultural relativism. All cultures are of equal value, and no one should have a right to assert that one culture is superior to another.
They should read up on the traditions of Christianity nonetheless, even if they're not going to use the language, because it provides the best model for a limited state, for liberal democracy, for secularism, and for constraining principles that protect the inherent worth of the person.
This comes right back to the value of ideas and of deep thinking that lies at the heart of Western freedom. It requires deep knowledge. I suspect you can't have wisdom without a lot of knowledge. You can certainly have knowledge with no wisdom, but I'm not sure you can have wisdom without a lot of knowledge and a lot of reflection time. And I wonder whether in the age of the 30-second grab, in the age when I know a bit about this, but it's got worse, politicians are so frenetic because of the demands placed on them, when there are so few people able to inform them out of our universities, whether we have the cultural depth now to preserve all that is good in our culture. It's going to be a very big test for us. I'd have to say, as an Australian, I think regardless of your worldview and your beliefs, this is a far more important debate than is being generally recognised. What should we seek to do? What should come out of the debate in Canberra around this issue?
I think in legislating religious freedom, we need to be, as I've said, be careful that it's defined or it includes a sense of positive liberty. And that means the free exercise of religion would include implicitly freedom of thought and expression. But we also need to assert the fundamental nature of the right to the free exercise of religion in society as a public right. And that means it has to be applied in the provision of goods and services, the use of private property, parental rights in education and so forth. There needs to be, what we saw in the initial debate around same-sex marriage was that people lost jobs, Christians lost their jobs, they were slandered and defamed on social media. There were events that were cancelled, Christian events that were to discuss same-sex marriage that were cancelled because very, very aggressive activists stopped people participating. People became afraid to speak out because they were attacked, sometimes physically. So we need to ensure that there is an anti-detriment provision in the legislation to protect people and organisations from being subjected to unfavourable treatment on the basis of belief. And I think that particular part has to include explicit reference to employment, accreditation and registration. I think we also need to ensure that the no harm principle is expressly articulated so that we define it as no physical harm or incitement to violence. We want to avoid this becoming a highly emotionalist issue. And we also I think, should ensure that MPs legislate Article 18 to prevent vexatious legislation, but also to ensure that state discrimination and equal opportunity laws can't override easily the right to religious, the free exercise of religion in society.
Well, it's going to be an extremely interesting, but I would argue very, very important debate, much more so than probably people in the street, and I'm not being critical of them at all. They're very busy people, they've got a lot on their plates, but it may have much more influence over the nature of our freedoms and our society than they've even begun to imagine.
It's a turning point in Australian cultural history.
Well, let's hope the debate is mature and sensible and not simply based on personal attacks and the sort of loathing we see too much of in social media, particularly today. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me, John.
You've been listening to Conversations with John Anderson. For further content, visit johnanderson.net.au.